Thank you so much. And hello.
Literally have this.
Ooh, hi guys. I'm going to adjust the mic here and not point it towards the other mic. Hello, Skylight Books, friends and family, which you all are if you're here. How is everyone doing today? Yay! Ready for books. So I'll remind everyone at the end, but we do have a raffle for Lindsay Klingel. Is her debut book is coming out in June, and it sounds amazing, and we're going to have a raffle for the one early copy that we have here. So it's going to be a really hot ticket item, so you're going to want to get that raffle. So I want to welcome everyone to First Draft Live. This is our second event, and this is the event in which we're going to be talking about fantasy books, fantasy, epic fantasy, dragons, all kinds of things. Ooh, closer. Okay. Whoa. Okay. Ooh, all right. I get loud, you guys, so just let me know if it's too much. Okay, so this is the IRL version of the First Draft Podcast, which is an author interview series available everywhere that podcasts exist. We have tons and tons of interviews that are already available, including two of these fine ladies, soon to be Lindsay as well. I'm sure we're going to talk about that later. And also Veronica Roth, Libba Bray, Leigh Bardugo, tons and tons of amazing authors on there. So I really suggest that you check it out. And today we're going to talk about, fantasy books, like I said, not to beat a dead horse, but we have Alyssa Sussman, Victoria Aveyard, Lindsay Klingel. All these ladies are writing really, really amazing fantasy books. And without further ado, we are going to talk to them about that. Starting with, actually, I want to sort of intro what makes a book a fantasy book, because when I was thinking about it, I wasn't able to answer that myself in a very clear manner. So if you guys have thoughts, is it dragons? Is it magic? Is it medieval societies? Like, what do you think makes big dresses? What do you think qualifies something as a fantasy story?
I probably should have Googled the answer so I would have sounded really smart. But for me, I don't think dragons, a medieval setting, I don't think those are necessarily the definition of fantasy. I think you can definitely have those things, and those are part of the tropes. But for me, I wrote a fantasy that has none of those things in it, and now in hindsight, I'm like, I wish I had some dragons.
It's not too late.
Book three. I think for fantasy, for me, is something that makes it different from and more impossible than our world. One of the best pieces of writing advice I ever got from a professor, particularly for writing genre, was you can make an audience believe one unbelievable thing, and everything else must make sense towards that unbelievable thing. So for me, when I'm writing genre, I try and pick what's different and then make everything else make sense with that. So I guess fantasy, one unbelievable thing that has affected the rest of that world.
I really like that. That's a really good piece of advice.
It was stolen from Janet Batchelor.
Oh, take it. Just take credit for that. What do you guys think? I know Alyssa likes dragons.
I love dragons. I think for me, a fantasy story is something that feels magical. Doesn't necessarily have to have magic in it, but it just has that kind of like feel and essence of kind of like the unknown, but what is different, because I feel like sci-fi and fantasy kind of are very similar, but sci-fi has like elements of modernism and like the future, and I think fantasy is a little more earthy, and sort of like going back to that kind of like intrinsic magic that we want to see in the world around us, and it's sort of a little more evident in a fantasy story.
Yeah, I think I would just add that I think of fantasy as something that's more epic in scale, and that kind of anything can happen, and that's why I'm kind of drawn to it. Yeah. Those are my favorite stories, because you're not really limited except for the rules that you set yourself, which can be limiting. But I think that you can tell a story as big as you want.
Yeah, you are setting me up perfectly for my next question, which was about the rules in fantasy, because you can't have a story where literally anything happens. I think that's why the one impossible thing stands out to me so much. You really need to constrict your world in order to like transcend those rules or make for a narrative tension at all. If your main character can actually do anything, there's not much of a story there, which is why I don't like Superman. Spoilers. So what do you guys, when you were writing a fantasy story, how did you guys approach making rules for your world? Was that challenging? Was it freeing? How did you kind of go about that process?
I think making rules for My first book was very freeing because I could make the rules that suited the story I wanted to tell. And then for the sequel, it was very challenging because now I had these rules to work with that didn't necessarily work with the story I wanted to tell. So that was much harder.
Pass, Lindsay.
Pass, Lindsay. I really like writing fantasy because it's me who gets to make up the rules. As much as I love historical fiction, I could never do the level of research required or that I would personally want to do to make sure everything's correct. So my natural inclination is, well, I'll make it up myself and I'll draw the map myself. Ha ha ha. And for me, at least with Red Queen, because it deals mostly with people who have superhuman abilities, it was finding out what the limitations of those things were, which are in this world was really fun to figure out, you know, someone who can control metal, what's an obstacle that they're going to run up against and how do I do that to them? So for me, it informed a lot of the story to figure out where the limits were going to be and how you were going to get people past them.
Did you come up with, side comment on that, did you come up with the rules, were the rules in tandem with coming up with the plot? I mean, it sounds like that was sort of one and the same.
A little bit. For me, I always work out from world building. I'm drawn to setting and world before I'm drawn to anything else. With Red Queen, the first thing I knew was there's going to be a teenage girl who can control lightning, and then I thought, what world has to happen for that to be real, for that to feel real in a book? So I built out and out and out from that, and then found a plot that I wanted to tell, which was, oh, a little bit of a rebellion, a little bit of, like, some royalty in there, and it all just kind of came together.
Yeah. That's kind of wild that that's where it all started, because when you are looking in from a fantasy world, there's so much that finding out what the original nugget is that's kind of amazing.
And I think it's interesting that you were talking about, like, historical fiction, because I actually get a lot of inspiration from stuff that has happened in history, because I think it's really interesting how unbelievable stuff is, you know, like, you look back on historical things and you're like, what? Really? Like, and how do we not know about that? And how did we allow it to happen? And so I actually drew a lot of inspiration from things that we've sort of forgotten about as a culture or choose to ignore, and just sort of that mindset was the basis of reality that I sort of built off of. So
do you think this is what actually was striking me about, you're talking about the difference between science fiction and fantasy, and it almost seems like when I think about science fiction, it's like Isaac Asimov stuff, like it's commenting on our society now based on where we're going. And some of fantasy seems like talking about our current society based on a little bit of more looking back. And it's interesting that both you guys brought up history in conjunction with those stories.
Yeah, and I think because a lot of fantasy stories like have that sense of, because a lot of them are based in like a medieval setting, and I think so it is that kind of like reinvention of the past, but giving it like sort of modern rules almost is a really fun sort of fantasy trope to play with.
Yeah, I like that it's like the idea that it's almost like fantasy is looking back in time long enough that anything could have been true, like dinosaurs were real. I don't know, dragons could be real too. It's just like we just don't remember. And then in the future, it's like anything's possible because AI, I don't know, maybe it's going to happen. So that's really, it's funny that they're paired so much when really there's differences that are harder to pinpoint than you might think. Mm-hmm. When you're looking at world building, how much detail is too much detail? I've seen Victoria get asked questions online that are like, why would she ever answer?
Oh,
like, there's too much. There's such a thing as too much world building.
Yeah.
I think JK has like ruined it for all of us, JK Rowling. Because, like, I mean, she has to have answers to all those questions, and now, so like,
she doesn't have to.
Well, she has allowed it, so.
Yeah, for JK Rowling, the limit does not exist.
Yeah, exactly.
For me, whenever I would write or attempt to write any kind of novel before I got into screenwriting, because novel was just too big for me at that point, I would overworld build and I would draw maps and like what currency they used and what religion was around 1,000 years before the story even started, which made no sense and I didn't need to know, but I would get so engrossed in the world building that I would burn out on world building. And it's no coincidence that the first novel I ever finished was Red Queen, where I did, quote unquote, the least amount of world building I've ever done. I had a map, I had several pages of notes and information, a couple of Excel sheets with names, and this is already sounding kind of intense. But yeah, and then I just kind of had to dive into the story, and there was a point where I told myself, no more of this, start writing actual character and plot, and we'll see how that goes. So I think there's something to be said for not burning out your energy and your inspiration on drawing trade routes.
Yeah, I think for me, it's something that you have to keep in mind is pacing, because my favorite stories, fantasy or otherwise, are ones that move a little quickly. And I think that's more true now than it was like when Tolkien was writing, you know, because I love Lord of the Rings, but some of those pages are hard to get through because there's a lot of descriptions of mountains and then
songs.
More mountains and then a forest. So I think... So anytime that I'm working on world building and I get bored writing it, then I know that it's going to be boring to read. So that's probably not essential.
That's a good marker. I think that's kind of a writing adage, right? If you're bored writing it, then no one's going to enjoy reading it.
And I think also there's like, you have to have a level of confidence when you're writing it. So it's like if you, as the writer, can convince the reader that the stuff that you're telling them is all they need to know, then they're going to sort of follow you without needing, you know, because I think like going back to Harry Potter, it's like there are plot holes everywhere, you know, but like we are so invested. But I mean, you know, like with any story, it's like there are just things that, you know, don't necessarily line up. But if you are committed to the world because the author has made it so real that you're just gonna be like, fine, that's cool. I buy it. I accept it. Let's go.
That's a good point, because I think where Tolkien, and I love Tolkien, but where he loses people rapidly is that there's not a lot of payoff for a lot of that detail, unless you read The Silmarillion, which I did. And then worth it.
But you know how they, Coco Chanel says, before you leave the house, take one thing off? For fantasy writing, I would say before you name that character, take out a damn apostrophe.
No Navi. That's a good rule. I'm going to cross-stitch that. So actually we heard a little bit about the nugget of the story and then a few pages of detail. I'd love to hear also from you guys, sort of when you're starting a project like this and you know, like, okay, I want to tell this epic fantasy story, like, that's huge. How do you start? Where do you begin?
I think, like Victoria said, with a nugget of an idea. The Marked Girl is about these people from a medieval time coming to LA, and I got that idea after my parents visited for the first time. And just seeing like all of these, you know, great landmarks that I had become accustomed to through their eyes, and that was sort of what started it.
That is amazing.
From there.
Amazing.
For me, for Red Queen, the nugget of the idea, it was I had this image of a teenage girl in an arena, kind of like Gladiator, and I knew she was going to be executed. I didn't know why. But then for whatever reason, when they go to kill her, she kills her executioner with lightning. And I thought, that's a story I would read. Like, I would like to experience that. And I started figuring
out... Which part?
I mean, who hasn't wanted to electrocute another person? Just a zap. Just a...
We may be revealing too much, but I agree.
Well, for me, it was, for Stray, the kind of, my obsession with Disney movies, and rewatching them, and watching Cinderella, and just kind of noticing the fairy godmother for the first time, and being like, what is her deal? You know, she's got all these magical abilities, but she just shows up, and then she disappears, and where did she go, and where did she come from? And it was kind of like wanting to tell a story about that kind of character that has this magic, you know, but it's kind of looked on as frumpy and, you know, scatterbrained, and what does that mean?
So, comic relief.
Comic relief, yeah, exactly. But yet she's, like, incredibly powerful, so.
Yeah,
now I'm mad for fairy godmothers.
Right? Fairy godmothers are pretty awesome, but they do not get...
No love.
They're due.
No love. I think that's one of the interesting things about really getting into writing is that then now when I watch movies and TV shows, a lot of the time with side characters, I'm like, wait, what's their movie? Like, what's their book? And there's a lot of, you know, I think a lot of books start that way. You were just saying something that I really wanted to dive into, and now I forget what it was. But let's ask Alyssa a specific question, because I have that prepared. Darn it. It'll come to me in the middle of your answer.
Okay. Just interrupt me.
So, with...
Do you want a cookie?
Snacks. Alyssa, you have... Okay, fantasy stories and fairy tales.
She's serving.
Oh, yeah. Alyssa brought amazing snacks. And everyone's
sorry.
Welcome, everyone's welcome to have
Shame.
Them.
I know. So embarrassed.
Burn and Stray... deal with fairy tales, which are kind of dealing with strong themes and motifs. There's a little bit of sort of, you know, there's like messages within those stories. And a lot of, I think, epic fantasy stories deal with that kind of thing. Like oppressive leaders, individuals defying societal expectations, there's all these quests, there's all these kind of like traditional things. When you're approaching telling a fantasy story, how much does do the tropes of that genre kind of weigh on you? Did you want to try to subvert them? How did you kind of deal with all the existing kind of really well-beloved works in that genre?
I think it's really fun to sort of have a story that everyone knows the basic ideas behind, because then you really get to, you already have their trust to an extent. You already have them believing in something, so you get a little more leeway. You have to like make sure you hold on to it, and I think, you know, people who love fairy tales can be very picky about retellings.
No.
What? Shocking. I think it's like, it's, there are just so many cool things in fairy tales, and the fact that they have, we all know them, you know, and the fairy tales that are like really popular versus the ones that aren't is really interesting to me as well. The kind of like themes that we seem to really connect to, like the story of Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty. It's like, why are we connecting to those stories versus like, you know, East of the Sun, West of the Moon, which is one of my favorite sort of lesser known stories, but it's kind of a more, you know, it's one of those few fairy tales where the female character is really the hero. She's like going out and getting the guy.
Did you answer that thesis? Why are we more connected to those stories?
That will be my next thesis. I don't know. I think it's that. We're starting to tell those stories now, and I think sometimes we forget that they did exist before. You know, and it's rediscovering those stories that have been part of our culture for a really long time.
Yeah.
I don't know if I answered your question at all, ramble about fairy tales.
No, just about subverting the themes and all that kind of stuff. Did you guys deal with, there's a lot of things that are traditionally in fantasy stories that can be useful, but maybe our readers looking for them, you worried about leaving some things out, like the big dresses and dragons and whatnot?
I miss my dragons. I didn't put any dragons in my books. So I'm very sad about that.
Again, there's still time.
Still time.
Yeah, I leaned into tropes pretty hard. I really love the fantasy genre, and what I thought was fun about writing this book is how would those tropes play out in Los Angeles. So getting to sit down and think them all through and then find an equivalent, like instead of storming a castle, they storm like an actor's house in Beverly Hills. And so I very deliberately, like the chapter titles are all sort of tropes that just play out here, and that was really fun to do, to pick and choose which tropes, but sadly also no dragons.
I didn't have any dragons, but I do have people who could, I guess, if they really wanted to, breathe fire. So that was fun.
Ooh.
In that I got to play around with superhuman powers and royalty, but it's sort of in a post-apocalyptic society where things have sort of reformed, and for whatever reason humans have evolved superpowers, and the people who have those superhuman abilities sort of run the show. Because I always thought, like watching X-Men or even Harry Potter, you have these people with magic or abilities and they're on the fringe, and I always thought, you know, that wouldn't really happen if like Professor X was out there, he would not be running from the government, he would be the government. So I tried to figure out what that kind of world would look like. And then in terms of fairy tale tropes, one that I really did hit on was sort of the princess trope of the poor girl is being made to marry a prince and it's such a dream, and there's a point in the story where she's like, this is a nightmare, I am a prisoner here and I don't want to be here. So that was fun to lean away from. And then I'm really, really inspired by George R.R. Martin and the Song of Ice and Fire series. The fact that he can take pretty much every trope in the book and flip them is really, really awesome. And I tried to do, you know, 1% of that. Plus just the way that he treats morality in his characters, and that there's no white or black. Every single person is gray. There's no good. There's no evil. Everyone's in between. Makes for very, very interesting characters, really fun characters to write, and just, I think, more truthful characters.
Yeah. He also believes in a lot of world building.
Yes.
Okay. Let's, Lindsay, I really want to hear more about how you came up with this story and modern day LA, possibly more about your parents.
Do they know that that's where the story came from?
They know now.
It's like the best inspiration story. I would love to hear you, like you were saying, it sort of sounds like, my question was, what was it like to see LA through the eyes of your characters? It sounds like you sort of already did that with your parents, and that's like where the book came from. So, I mean, what was it like to sort of? I would love to hear more about how you decided to use those tropes and the process of figuring out what in LA would correlate. That's so cool.
Yeah. Well, basically, this is my first book, and I just put in everything that I love, which is Los Angeles and fantasy novels and cheeseburgers, and then that was like where I started. So it made it really easy because I just really love this city. So I was able to like take all of my favorite places and figure out what a medieval prince would think of them, like. Or
so it's not. It's coming from a place of LA love, because I've talked to people who put LA in books, but it's because they want to like destroy it with fire.
Yeah, and I hate that. And that's sort of like because I was kind of playing with the concept that LA is considered a fantasy world as well. So these people aren't just coming to a modern day Earth; they're coming to a place where a lot of things are also fake, and that's a lot to deal with too. So it's sort of interesting just to play with not just how they would see cars, but how they would see like people pushing dogs in strollers and like movie sets where everything is fake anyway. So that was fun.
Ooh, I like that. So I really hope your parents hear this. I'm so excited about this. Let's go back. I would love to hear, we talked a little bit about fairy tales and George R. R. Martin and Harry Potter, but what are other fantasy stories that got you guys really into the genre? Like when you were a kid growing up, what are some early stories that you really fell in love with?
Sure. I think the very first kind of fantasy story that I loved was Peter Pan. This ageless kind of person comes and takes these British kids off on an adventure, and it's very epic. And also, which now that I'm thinking of it explains why I love Doctor Who.
And ooh, I like that. Right into sci-fi.
Yeah, it all connects. And yeah, I think that was the first one that kind of got me into how epic those stories can be and how you could just leave your world behind.
How did you encounter that story first? Was it like an actual like fairy tale book that you were reading? Was it Hook? Or
no, it was definitely the cartoon.
I forgot about that one.
Definitely the Walt Disney Peter Pan. And then from there, also The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was really big. Mm. Love portal stories. Yeah. Big fan of them.
So. More Doctor Who.
Yeah, for me, it started with movies as well, because I couldn't like read until you were 5 or 6 or whatever. So I consider Star Wars a fantasy. So I think I was about 3 when I saw those movies, because my family is really into movies and letting us watch movies when we were way too young for them. But that one's always stuck with me as sort of the pinnacle of what you can achieve with a story and how into another world you can get. And then for books, I guess the earliest fantasy book I ever read was probably Ella Enchanted by Gail Carson Levine. That was one of my really big ones and always stuck with me. I actually started writing stories because of The Legend of Zelda video game, though.
Tell me everything about that.
Okay. I got a story.
Oh, my God.
It's not that big of a story. So my brother got Ocarina of Time for the N64, and he would never let me play. So I would sit there with the guidebook and like help him do the levels, and that was my version. That was me getting to play, quote unquote.
Oh my gosh,
which is really sad. But I got really into the maps, and I've always been into maps since then. So I started drawing my own terrible little Hyrule knockoff maps, and then I got thinking, you know, who lives in this little world that I've drawn, and like changed all the names by one letter. So I would start writing really terrible one-page stories about them, and that's how I got into writing. And then I guess I'm a crazy Lord of the Rings freak too. Books and movies, all about it.
We would have been hanging out when we were kids, basically.
Oh, yeah.
Reading Lord of the Rings and playing Zelda.
I definitely got made fun of for my doorstop that I carried around in middle school.
Yeah, those were not jokes.
Nope.
Well, for me, I always go back to this book series, Dealing with Dragons. Dragons. Which
dragon book.
Oh. Well, here's the thing, is that the very, very first version of Stray was, like, a really bad fan fiction of Dealing with Dragons. And it was, like, all about, like, this main character who's, like, a dragon activist and blah, blah, blah. And it was, it was horrible. It was so bad.
And this is available where? Put it online.
Online. No, but it was, and it's, like, the whole thing about, like, leaning on tropes, because it really is the princess trope, and it builds on this idea of, like, you know, dragons are always stealing princesses, and so this one princess, Cimmerine, which is, like, one of the most amazing names ever, is like, I don't want to be a princess, I'm going to go hang out with the dragons. I'm gonna go ask one of them to basically like hire me to be their like cook and librarian, and like that's what I'm gonna do with my life. And it's just amazing. And so that is like was a huge influence for me and my like love of that kind of style of fantasy and the fairy tale feel to it. But like I think probably my early, you know, like the Disney movies and like Little Mermaid.
Yeah,
I mean, Little Mermaid is the perfect movie. It's the most perfect movie of all time.
Do you think that?
Period.
Agreed. Do you think that's a fantasy story? I mean, it is because there's otherworldly, there's magic, and
I mean, do you know a lot of mermaids?
I mean, we could talk about that off mic.
Offline. It's getting a little personal.
I hadn't thought about that. wait, but I'm super into this. Okay, let's talk about why Star Wars is a fantasy story. I want to hear. It sounds like you have some like maybe an outline with bullet points for us.
No.
Also online.
Yeah. I mean, it starts a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
But then there's blasters and Millennium Falcon.
I think it's more of a fantasy story than a science fiction because the science is not core to the story. It's the tropes of the princess, the scoundrel, the farm boy. I could go on.
You did just name an Alexa Bracken book, which
is really fantastic. Yes, I did. So. I love that book. But yeah, it has so many different archetypes and tropes that have come from mythology and come from fantasy. You know, the hero with 1,000 faces is how Star Wars was written. Sorry, I went to George Lucas's film school, so they drill this into us.
I want this.
But yeah, I definitely think it's a fantasy story over a sci-fi. I think sci-fi there is window dressing, and fantasy is the beating heart of that story.
Okay, I like that.
I very much agree. Yeah, because it's almost the most archetypal fantasy story there is. There's the orphaned farm boy who goes off on a journey and defeats a great evil. That's as basic as it gets. So basic that even though it's not the first of its kind, it feels like it is. Like, it feels like Star Wars invented that, and that's what a lot of other movies and stories come from, even though that's not true, but those are thousands of years. Yeah, so I think it's definitely a fantasy.
I feel like fantasy books are what theme parks get built about. And it doesn't really happen for very many other stories. Because, the Star Wars park
Jurassic is... Jurassic Park is sci-fi.
Okay. Touché. I love it. Okay. Well, related to what stories you love and feel connected to, what fantasy world would you become a part of, if you could? And as what character?
I always thought I would make a really excellent hobbit. I just really dig their lifestyle. They snack a lot. They live in a really cute underground house. They, have parties.
They have the best houses.
Yeah. I mean, I love... Game of Thrones is one of my favorite shows, and I love the series, too. But I would not survive that. I think all of us want to think that, we're an Arya deep down inside, but, I'd be townsperson who dies in episode 2. So, yeah, hobbit for me.
Doomed hobbit town life. Person.
Yeah, I guess adding to the hobbit thing, they have it pretty well made, especially in comparison to the rest of Middle Earth. Like in Rohan, the king lives under a barn, and in Hobbiton, they have a post office in glass, so they're doing very well. But
In the movies, it never even gets to them, which we could also talk about offline because
exactly.
that needed to be in the movies. Mm-hmm. But in the movies, they're stone cold, got it made.
Yes, exactly. But I don't think if I didn't have to be in Lord of the Rings and I couldn't be guaranteed a hobbit, I would want to be guaranteed acceptance here to Hogwarts.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not a squib. I refuse. I refuse to be a squib.
I refuse.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in a second Hogwarts, but I want to go there, after Voldemort's been defeated. Like, I don't want to be there while it's happening.
Take the risk.
You think you're going to survive?
I think more kids survive that than survive Game of Thrones.
Well, that's true. I mean, comparatively, yes.
You could leave before the battle. There was, an open door policy.
That's true. But then you're totally going to know. Everyone's going to know that you're the kid.
They kicked out all the Slytherins. I get kicked out.
Well, that's only in the movie.
I'm not a Slytherin, so I would not get kicked out. So.
I am, so.
I'm totally a Ravenclaw. Totally, yeah. Yes. Totally.
Wait, do we all know? Do you have the Pottermore officially sanctioned?
Also a Ravenclaw, but with more Hufflepuff than I'm, comfortable admitting.
Me too! So true. There's so many of us.
Did you guys see, I don't know if anyone else had this experience, apparently it's been going on for like a year and a half, but I only saw it today because Lev Grossman tweeted about it, but this girl is writing modern Harry Potter, and it's her own version of where these characters have gone in the years after, and I know JK is like about to fill us in and ruin all of our like mental concepts of what happened with them, but this took me an hour to read in bed this morning, which tells you a lot about my life. And but it was,
bet you're making the right choices.
Thank you. Me and my cat. It was brilliant. It's sort of written in vignette style, and it just follows all the characters, and like George and Hermione start to become a thing, and it's this whole like,
no.
I was
what?
Like,
no.
Oh no,
last week. No.
I will link to it in the show notes on this podcast.
I won't
but
read it.
She's so skillful that she got me there. Okay, let's see. Oh, I do want to talk. Victoria, Red Queen is going to be a movie.
Ooh,
so exciting. Yeah, knock on wood. Elizabeth Banks is involved, so I feel like it's more, I feel like I can just go ahead and say it because she's so cool. So seeing that the theme park thing, Red Queen becoming a movie, which just makes total sense to me. There's so much about fantasy books and fantasy stories that it's so visual and seems to sort of invite. They're the first stories I think that people are like, oh, this should be a movie. I want to interact with this world. You know, it sort of becomes consuming in this way. So what do you think it is about the stories that makes they really like visual is the word that keeps coming to me. They kind of require you to build all of that out.
Yeah, I think they naturally search for stories that are visual and immersive, and also stories that sell books. So built-in audience is what they're always looking for. I guess was that for Red Queen? Yeah, I'm also a working screenwriter. That's what my background is in. So it was kind of natural to write a book and structure it the same way a screenplay is. So I guess I was already kind of speaking the language, and I knew what the avenues were and how things would be going down. So now we're sitting very happily at Universal. We have our writer, we have our director, and we're just kind of like seeing how things go from there.
So exciting.
It's very early on in the process.
So. Yeah. How did you, other ladies, how did you go about making your books really visual? I know when you know, reading can be so sort of dry when you think about it, but fantasy books tend to just bring a person into this world. Like, how did you go about making it immersive? Alyssa's pointing away from herself.
I also think I write in a way that I think I'd see it as if it were a television show or a movie. Also have background writing scripts. So, and in that case, when you write a script, you have to put so much of the work into dialogue and really make it so that the reader can fill in the blanks themselves. And I think that's how I wanted to do the book too. Again, just not focusing on the mountains and instead focusing on the characters. And so that helps to write in a way that people can visualize it themselves and fill in those blanks themselves.
Yeah. Do you want to jump into this?
Yeah. Well, I think I have a really hard time doing that.
Really?
So, yeah, I think for me, I have a much easier time writing like the internal sort of dealings with characters, and when it comes to showing what's around them, I have a very difficult time doing that, and really need to be like my editor was like, what do they see? What do they smell? What do they hear? I'm like, I know what they're thinking, you know, like that's all that it's an important thing to me. So it's like, it's a struggle for me to definitely like look outward.
So for you, a story doesn't play out in your head like a movie when you're sitting in front of your laptop?
Not at all. Yeah.
Do you,
I mean, you're doing pretty well, so I think.
Well, it's super interesting. Do you, when you read books, do you see them as a movie?
Yeah, I think.
You think so?
I think so.
You sound uncertain about that.
I don't even know. I don't even know if I like if I have a act like a.
The reason
I'm a writer. This is great. Yes, total block. There's nothing between this year and this year. It's just.
It's like Homer Simpson's cartoon.
Yeah, I'm gonna pass this.
Oh. Well, the reason I harped on that a little bit, and maybe unfairly to you, but I had a friend that I was an English major with, and at some point in our 4 years of going to every class together, she was like, "I don't picture a book while I read it," and it was like. What? I was like, well, what are you doing? She's like, I'm reading and hearing the story. And I was like, I don't actually understand how you love books as much as I do. It was such a weird moment for me realizing that there's so many different ways to experience a story and you don't have to envision it that way. But my tag along to that question is, I love that you both are writing screenplays too. Because It's fascinating to me. When I thought about doing it or the process of it, I was like, okay, so you write the screenplay, I get it. Then you hand it off to other people. Mm-hmm. I was like, no. And I had no idea that I was such a control freak until it was like, oh, and then your story is contributed to and changed by other people. So is that why you guys are both sitting here, because of books? So did you realize that you also want control over a story in that way?
I landed in books just because that's what happened for me first, is my novel writing career got off the ground a lot faster than screenwriting. And then after I had sold my first manuscript, that's when I started to got my first screenplay sold. But it just was a great indication of how different the two things are, and both the pros and the cons to each, because at least with a screenplay, it's a much more collaborative all the way through process, in terms of, like, I write an outline, my management team and I go through it, and we rewrote an outline three times, and then I go to screenplay, and then I rewrite that three times with their help. Whereas, at least in my experience with publishing now, my editor is like, okay, I don't need to see a summary, I don't need to see anything, I just want to see the first draft when it's done. And I'm like, what? I'm alone? And even my agent was like, well, you can send me, you know, what you need to send me, just so that makes you more comfortable. And I'm like, well, yeah, if I'm running off a cliff, I would like to know, please. But yeah, just by virtue of screenplays are so much faster, so much more immediate, you have to tell a story very, very quickly, get in and get out. Your pacing is very, very different, and you have to be really economical with your language. You have to be able to explain a scene in two sentences, maybe. And grammar doesn't really matter, which is excellent. And then you come to novels, and you're like, oh my God, I can describe this room the way I want to describe it and really show what my brain is thinking. So you can get kind of overindulgent in the opposite direction. But it's cool, because people always ask, what do you like better, screenplays or books? And I'll say, whatever I'm not working on at the time is the one I prefer.
Yeah, I think there's pros and cons for both. I worked as an assistant in writers' rooms for TV shows, and just seeing these people who had years of experience and writing these great drafts that got torn apart by, you know, there's just so many layers of notes that they had to contend with, and they would do it pros, like, yeah, okay, we'll throw it all out and start from scratch, and that was just the way of it. So I learned how to do it that way. On the other hand, it was hugely collaborative, so that if someone got stuck, you got ideas, you could say someone else would come up with something better. And then when I sold the book, it was great, because it was like, you know, it was all my words, but it was also terrifying. And I remember when I got my edit letter, and my editor was like, well, these are just suggestions. I'm like, I'm going to do them all. I trust you. But then you don't have the collaboration on a daily basis, so that can be hard too, because you don't know, like, if you're gonna run off a cliff. You're just there in your pajamas hoping for the best. So
yeah, all of our lives.
Definitely one of the most valuable things I took from screenwriting education is how to take notes and how to take criticism, either good or bad, and how not to A, internalize those things, but B, understand what they're saying and find the nuggets of truth and what they're trying to help you with. So then when I came to publishing and all I had was this one manuscript and an agent who was interested, and she came back with, I like it, it needs a lot of work, we got to cut 40,000 words and you have to change the ending. My first response wasn't to barf all over myself. It was, okay, let's work on this. So I definitely advise taking any kind of workshop writing or screenwriting class, just to get the thick skin that you need to work in any kind of creative industry that has any collaboration process whatsoever. Because if you're going to take it personally when someone says, well, I didn't get this, it's not the job for you.
It's going to be an uphill battle. Actually, I would love to hear Alyssa. I know Alyssa is right now in an MFA program, and she's dealing with a lot of critique and workshopping and stuff like that. And you had some really great thoughts about it that I'd love you to share. Well, Alyssa talks about it on the podcast that we did together a little bit. But
yeah, I mean... Sorry.
No, you just had great notes about what critique is and how to figure out what critique to take.
Yeah, I mean, I really think that what Victoria was saying is true, and I think it's such good advice to every writer, every creative person to get used to getting criticism, getting notes. And yeah, because it is you know, you really do have to be thick-skinned, and you have to really be able to figure out what good criticism is and what bad criticism is, because I think, and also I think you learn that by giving criticism, because I think we all, you know, have this idea that our opinion is valid criticism, and it is when it's like, you know, when you're suggesting a book to someone else and you're like, you know, I liked this because of this and this, but if you're giving criticism to someone with the hopes of improving their work, your opinion isn't really the important thing, and you have to learn how to think about what the author is trying to say and the story that they're trying to tell, and then be able to give them criticism. And I think when you can do that for other people, you get better at reading and figuring out the criticism you're getting and figuring out what is going to be good for you and what's going to be bad for you.
What I've also found, and I don't know if this is true for anyone else, but for me, a lot of times, and this is going to loop back, but a lot of times when I find traits about other people annoying, mm-hmm. I then realize that it's because I do that, and that it's like, oh, right. This is something that I hate that I do, and that's why I'm noticing it. And I think the same thing is true in critique. A lot of the times I'll find myself critiquing a book for someone, and I'll be like, no, too much description. And then it's like, oh, right. I also have to cut 40,000 words and change the ending. Yeah. So I think there's a lot to be gained all kinds of ways from getting better at critique.
And it's so much easier to see problems in other people's work than it is to see it in your own, you know. Mm-hmm. Obviously you feel very tender, and I mean hopefully you feel tender towards your work, but I think it's all right. But I think that being able to pull back a little bit and learning how to pull back is really helpful. And I think being in critique, you know, and a lot of times you find critique partners that way, you know, which is like so important, to find people who you trust, who you feel have your best story in mind and are going to be able to read it and give feedback that is helpful, and that they, you know, and I think the best way to find it is like find people who love the same stories that you do, you know.
And actually, I would love to hear you guys talk about, I loved hearing you guys talk about missing collaboration, when it's nice to be a control freak with your novel and then also like, help, plot, what's happening? Do you guys have people that you look to like bounce ideas off of? Is there someone who knows, even as your first draft writing, what's happening in your story?
I don't know if she remembers this, but Alyssa was one of the first people to read my story. Because I have a writing group, but it's for TV writing. We meet once a week, and I didn't really have a lot of people that I felt comfortable foisting this, like, 400-page manuscript on. It was a lot of work. And, a friend of a friend introduced me to Alyssa, and she was kind enough to read it, not knowing me at all, and give me some great notes that, I was able to send it out to an agent, so thank you.
Yay.
but I do think it's a harder ask, just because books are so much longer and so much work to critique. So, make sure that you're doing it back for them.
Did you have, though, when you were talking about these panicking in your pajamas alone in your house moments, do you have, like, someone that you can shout to in the other room who can help you, like, figure out what's going to happen next?
Yeah, my dog, Big Head.
No. Pets are the most helpful.
Your name is Big Head?
Yes, you would understand if you met him.
We'll post a picture in the podcast notes.
I think another really cool thing about living in LA is that so many people that I've met out here are also storytellers or in the industry and are really great to bounce ideas off of. And a lot of them also love stories. And so getting to talk about all these movies that come out and television shows, like, I trust their opinions because they like the same things I like. And
that's huge.
For me, when I was first writing the manuscript for Red Queen and sort of flying by the seat of my pants, had moved home to write a book situation. There were two people who were reading it as I was writing it, and they would read each chapter as I finished. I would send it to them. It was my best friend and my dad, and neither of them are writers. So there was no like creative echo coming back to me. No one was telling me like, oh, I didn't like this foreshadowing. But when I started to slow down and think that this book was garbage and it wasn't going anywhere, they would both start to bug me and be like, okay, well, if you quit, I would like to know what happens. So if you could just finish the book, that'd be great. So it was peer pressure that made me finish writing.
That's really sweet.
And then after I got signed and sort of started getting pulled into the publishing world, I found a friend online who has become sort of a CP and reads my stuff as I'm going along. And she gives really great notes and is a good little cheerleader, kind of. I don't like to take that many notes as I'm writing, just because I think it slows you down a lot. I don't like to self-edit too much. I like to get to the end first and then go back. My agent is also a really, really great editor, so she's cool.
Yeah, I mean, sort of not exactly what you're talking about, but kind of going off of what you just said, I think it's good to have, like, to have the really, you know, great critique partners, but it's also nice to have like the person who's just going to be like, it's wonderful. You just need one of those people. I mean, you don't have a whole, like, you know, group of them. But like, it's like, I think when you really are having that kind of like awful feeling, it's nice to have someone be like, you wrote a book, good job, you know, and that's sort of will get the wind back in your sails, I think.
Really, I had someone that I sent an email every morning while I was like rewriting something, and she was just like, you're pretty and this is amazing, and I was like, she was my Leslie Knope. We should all be so lucky as to have a Leslie Knope in our lives. Yes,
beautiful tropical fish.
Yes, and I don't mind being Anne either. Listen, Anne was great.
When you're working from home, it's really easy once you start getting into a negative headspace to like let yourself live there, which is why it's helpful. You know, I have my boyfriend read everything that I write, but I tell him he can't say anything bad about it. So,
good rule.
Same for my mom. Like, I just can't take like criticism from my mom like that. So I always have like two people who will always just say, "No, it's really good," and I choose to believe them, even though I told them to tell me that. So, that really.
I have a contract I like people to sign. You will not say anything negative to me. We are actually going to take some audience questions now. And I think we will probably just use this mic, or if people can yell really loud, then we'll repeat the question. But does anyone have a question that they would like to ask any of the panelists? Maybe about Big Head. You guys have anything? I'm looking at Emery because she's in town. We're excited. We have a bunch of YA writers. Everyone knows I have more questions. We do sort of get to a lot of advice in the podcast, and you guys have given really good advice for fantasy writers, but I'd love to just hear sort of general advice for people that are getting into novel writing. What would you tell them?
I'm going to focus again on fantasy and say that if you have a story in mind that's in the fantasy genre, just ask yourself one question, which is, how is this different than everything that came before? And I think that will really kick you off in a strong way, because once you answer that, then you know everything else kind of falls in line. So just so many things have been done, but are you like mashing genres? Are you asking a question that's never been asked? And yeah, I think that'll kick you off.
My advice for people wanting to write, get a thick skin, finish what you're working on, get to the end, eyes on your own paper, and don't take shit from anybody.
Yeah, wait, do you want to explain eyes on your own paper? Because that is, like, one of the most helpful pieces of advice.
Yeah, it's pretty easy, at least in publishing, because it's such an inclusive world, and once you're in it, it's Twitter and Tumblr and social media is really, really pervasive, and it's great because we get to form all these relationships with people who might never meet, but you get this nice sort of support group. But at the same time, you hear about everybody's highlight reel, kind of. You see their Instagrams, you see their trips and whatever, and oh boy, this person sold this many units, or this person's this rank on Amazon, and you sort of either want to compare, you naturally want to compare yourself. Humans are naturally competitive. So a little bit of that is healthy and it's good and it can fuel you, but at the same time, your journey is so much different than everyone else's. Everyone has a completely different path, even if they all look like they're doing one thing and you're doing another. We're only seeing the outside. So,
That? It's like, don't compare your... You said highlight reel. Yeah. It's like, don't compare your everyday to someone's highlight reel. It's a really great way of thinking, because it's very easy. I've seen people in a lot of non-publishing contexts get wrapped up in that, and I'm like, oh, we talk about this all the time. What you're doing is. Yeah. So I think it's such good advice for everybody.
Yeah.
I think a lot of what Victoria said, and, you know, I think the most important thing is really finishing something, you know, because that is the hardest part, having something that you can edit. So you just have to get through that incredibly horrible first draft, because every single first draft is horrible. Like, no matter how long, being in an MFA program, I'm working with writers who, you know, are in their, you know, on their, you know, 10th, 12th, 15th, 20th book, and they all say the same thing, that it's every time you start a new book, it is just as hard and it is just as miserable and terrible, and why we do this over and over and over again, who knows. But like, you just have to get through that horrible mess of a first draft, and then you can fix everything afterwards.
Yeah, it's really weird. I was like, if because all that is true, and if hearing that it doesn't ever get easier and that every book is uniquely awful doesn't make you want to quit doing what you're doing, then maybe you're built to be a writer.
Yeah,
that's like, doesn't ever stop being true.
No.
Do we have any audience questions? Yay, we have a couple. You can just stand up and shout it out, and we'll repeat the question, please.
this has been ridiculous, but I'm just curious because I've never been in such a thing. You've got four lovely writers. So here it goes. Do you ever go to like Yellowstone or Big Sur or Joshua Tree?
Do you ever shout into the void? Let me rephrase that. So the question is, do we as writers ever maybe get to a breaking point where we need to go on like retreats or to places of great beauty and possibly alter our minds in any way to be inspired for book ideas?
I actually go to Yellowstone a fair bit. I love Yellowstone. I love the national parks.
Shout out to our national parks.
Yeah, I thank the National Park Service in every single one of my books. The first two chapters of Red Queen were written in Montana.
That's amazing. So, I'm going to thank Teddy Roosevelt in mine.
I know. Yeah, I do like to travel and work on the road. I love working in places of great beauty. I'm more of a drinker than a mushroom taker, personally.
Love it. Let's
But I, as a rule, do not drink and write. I don't smoke and write or anything like that. I just can't work that way. I know plenty of people who can and they produce that way, but it's just not something I want to have to rely on at this point in my career.
I know Victoria has seen my blog in which I exclusively post pictures of me writing in bars.
I want to kind of start doing that, but also like my fans are, a lot of them are 14.
Yeah, a young adult makes it a little tricky.
I always have to preface with, I'm 25, it's legal.
Do you guys do retreats? Other,
I'm not what you'd call a nature person. So
she loves Los Angeles.
I do. I think when I need like a mental break, that's when I go to the movies or watch TV. So that's like every day for several hours. But I also not into mushrooms.
Oh, that was specifically what the question
was. I guess that goes against the Hobbit thing from earlier. But
good point.
Those aren't hallucinogenic, though.
That we know of.
Pipe weed.
Yeah.
Well, that's what they were smoking.
Yeah. I do.
It was in the Two Towers, guys.
I think, like, wine and beer is my treat for finishing because I also can't drink and write. Like, Hemingway did it, and bless him, but I need coffee.
We don't need
focus.
To emulate. We don't need to emulate Hemingway in life.
Can't do it. The second I have a glass of wine, my mind is gone. So
yeah. I don't go outside either. and that's it. No, I think my way of sort of clearing my mind is. I call it like a fake nap where I just like, I mean, sometimes I do fall asleep and actually take a nap, but like lay down and just kind of like, you know, actually kind of just like clearing your head, which I can just do on my own. So it's usually.
That's like the last 15 minutes of a yoga class for me.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Like, think deep thoughts. And I'm like, I'm asleep for sure.
Good night. Thank you.
I just went to Joshua Tree recently and I would love to do that. And I find that I can drink until 1.5 glasses of wine. Well, that's my answer. We had another question you want to, Brandon, ask?
What are you guys reading right now?
Ooh, good question. We have 15 minutes for this answer, so. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm actually rereading Shadow Scale, which is Rachel Hartman's companion to Serafina. I just reread Serafina, and I'm rereading Shadow Scale, which is, when I first read that book, it captured exactly the feel I got when I read Dealing with Dragons for the first time. And it's dragons, so bring it back to dragons, all about dragons. And it's one of my favorite fantasy books, especially YA fantasy books of the past, you know, few years.
I just saw Hamilton, so I'm on a bit of a Revolutionary War kick. So I'm currently reading 1776 by David McCulloch, and I'm also reading Hidden Bodies by Carolyn Kepnes, which just came out. It's the sequel to the book You, and it is this really unsettling, like sociopathic thriller book written in second person. I highly recommend it. The first book's set in New York. The second one is set in Franklin Village, and it's creeping me the hell out because this serial killer stalker guy is all up in the area.
Whoa. So well, Charles Manson was here too. So
yeah. But it's very weird for him to be like, I went into Birds and waited for you, and you're like, oh my God. I was in Birds.
is that YA or it's adult?
No.
Sounds like.
I made the mistake because someone asked this question. I was just on tour and some teenager asked this question and I started to say, oh, it's this book called You, blah, blah, blah. And I had to stop and be like, have your moms read it first. I'm in trouble.
Yeah, so my book's coming out this year, so I'm part of this kind of club called the Sweet 16s, which is sort of like a debut author kind of group, and we all send each other our books, which is really fun. So right now I'm reading The Devil and the Bluebird by Jennifer Mason Black, and it's awesome. So
that sounds great.
Another Sweet 16er.
Yay! I do want to... Maureen, would you mind helping me? If anyone didn't get a raffle, this is a free raffle for an early copy of Lindsay's book, which doesn't come out till June, but sounds so amazing, and I want to make sure that before we finish that everyone has a raffle ticket because we'll draw those. So final question and just kind of a quick blast is what made you guys choose YA? Why do you like writing YA?
It was always my favorite genre to read. And so every story that I think of, I'm always like, how can I tell this through the point of view of a teenager? Because that's favorite stories those are the stories I like reading and watching. So it made sense to write it.
Yeah, in my opinion, YA just means your main character is between the ages of 14 and 18. So Harry Potter is YA, no matter how many people will tell you, oh, no, it's better than that. Well, screw you. I'd like to shoot you. That's on tape.
That's fair.
But yeah, I always knew the story was about a girl who was 17 years old just because I started writing the story when I was 21. It was a very close age, and it's a very transitional age, and everything seems so much crazier even in a normal life. So putting it into an extraordinary life, you just up the stakes that much more. I think in YA, the limits are really, really vast. You can do pretty much anything. You can mash genres. You can go with tropes, or you can spin them around. You can do anything you really want, and it's really freeing.
It reminded me of when you guys were talking about how scripts demand that you move forward. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of that in YA. I was reading a book I will not name. That was an adult book. It was a big deal last year, and I was like, oh, at page 560, was like, I can't do this. It was so far from being done, and I was like, I gotta get back to YA.
If there aren't family trees, I can't stick with a book for 500 pages.
I think YA is really fun because those characters are usually experiencing things for the first time, and they get to experience them with such heightened emotions, which a lot of people, you know, criticize YA for, but I think that is what makes it so special and so exciting to write. And then the readers of YA, the teenagers, are just the best readers in the world. Like, you never get a better group of passionate, excited readers, because this is their first love, experiencing it for the first time, and that's what it always comes like. Always trying to recapture that for myself, and being able to see it in your readers is like the coolest thing ever.
They have intense joy.
They do, and that's so awesome.
Yeah. Thank you, ladies, so much. We are going to wrap up now, and actually, Lindsay, would you like to draw the winning raffle number for an early copy of The Marked Girl, which is coming out in June 2016?
Hey, so I'm not sure which number is the last three.
I think you can just say the last three.
185.
Yay! Okay, I have just a few thank yous, and then everyone can attack the snacks and ask us more questions about Star Wars and Poe/, which I promised Twitter we would discuss and we didn't get to yet. So first and foremost, thank you, Skylight Books, for being so generous with us and for hosting us. This is amazing.
You've been listening to the Skylight Books Author Reading Series. Don't forget that you can listen to this and all of our other great podcasts at skylightbooks.com. Thanks again for stopping by. And we hope to see you soon.